A time for us to get started this morning. So let's start with a word of prayer. Let's bow together. Righteous Heavenly Father, thank you so much for the gifts that you have given us today. Thank you especially for our time together to study from your word, to study about your servant Daniel. Father, we thank you specifically for this story that we're looking at about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and their faithfulness, their rejection of idolatry, how they stood up for you in front of the king. Father, I pray that you grant us the sort of strength that they had. Help us, Father, to live our lives daily as a living sacrifice to you, as they yielded up their bodies to you. Righteous Father, thank you for the gifts that you've given us in your Son. Help us, Father, as we encounter life's trials, to remember the hope that we have in your Son, especially the hope that we have of the resurrection. It's in Jesus' name that we offer our prayer. Amen. All right. Well, those of you that I didn't get to see on Thursday, I am very glad to see you this morning. We're glad to be back, is what I mean. After a long trip like that, we are glad to be home. We have been studying in Daniel chapter 3. And Daniel chapter 3, if you'll remember, is the story of the burning fiery furnace. So Daniel's three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or as they are referred to repeatedly in this text, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they are confronted with this trial. Nebuchadnezzar sets up this gigantic image, and he commands, he brings all of his provincial officials together, and he sets them up in front of this this idol, and he tells them, not in so many words, in more words actually, but he tells them, all right, whenever I strike up the band, you're all going to bow down and worship this idol, or I'm going to throw you in the burning fiery furnace. And the text tells us that they strike up the band, and all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, except for the three friends here. On Thursday, we focused on the nature of the idol. It is, if you look at the dimensions, it's 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. So that means it's really, really stretched out of proportion. You know, 10 times taller than it is wide. And we noted just the sort of reaction that Nebuchadnezzar got, which is almost immediate obedience. If we're just reading up through verse 7, as soon as the band is struck up, everybody falls down and worships the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. We also talked about the purposes for Nebuchadnezzar doing this. It's not that Nebuchadnezzar is really pious about his Babylonian gods, about Bel-Marduk or Nabu or any of those guys. He's doing this to get loyalty, right? And we noted on Thursday that at one point in his kingship, Nebuchadnezzar had to put down a revolt, and he went on tour through the western part of the empire collecting tribute, and that the text does not tell us when this happens, but knowing that historical background helps us understand why Nebuchadnezzar is so concerned about loyalty and why he's gathered the particular people that he's gathered. Let's see. Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So he's not just calling, you know, any schmuck living in the Babylonian Empire. He's calling specifically his officials who are in charge of running the empire to ensure their loyalty. And he gets it, except from Daniel's three friends, Ananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And I want to start this morning with a question that Mary asked on Thursday that we weren't able to get around to. We focus on the three friends here, but this is not the book of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. This is the book of Daniel. Right? We typically think of Daniel as the main character here. Where is Daniel in all of this? The text doesn't tell us. I mean, that's the short answer. The text doesn't tell us in Daniel chapter 3 where Daniel is at in all of this. There are really just a couple of possibilities. I think both of them are worth at least looking at. The first possibility is that Daniel is elsewhere, and he is not at all involved in this incident. The last thing that we read in Daniel chapter 2, remember, after Daniel interprets the vision, Nebuchadnezzar pays him homage and starts heaping praises and rewards on him. And Daniel requests, Daniel made a request to the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. All right, and by the way, that explains why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are there. They are officials over the province of Babylon. All right, so they fall into that list that we read at the beginning of chapter 3, officials from all the provinces. All right, they're among those men that Nebuchadnezzar wants loyalty from. But notice what it says about Daniel. But Daniel remained at the king's court. All right, so Daniel gets promoted very, very quickly, just straight up the chain. He is not just some random official out in the provinces somewhere. He's not even like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They've been given a place of high honor by being officials not just over any province, but the province around the capital city. All right, so they get to stay, you know, around Babylon, the city. But they are provincial officials. They're covering a territory. Daniel, he gets to stay in the king's court. He is by Nebuchadnezzar's side himself. And it is possible, and again, we know that the king, after he put down this revolt, one of the first things that he did was he purged his army. Or he went through and he executed any generals or commanders that he thought were involved in this revolt. And so it's not unlikely that he did the same thing through his court, or just the people immediately around him, he went through and purged. And it may be that that Nebuchadnezzar at this point already considered Daniel to be loyal and therefore did not put him to the test. So it could be that as everybody is out there on the plain, confronted with this gigantic, ridiculous statue, that Daniel is safe in the court of the king back in Babylon. That could be it. The other possibility is a lot more uncomfortable to us. The other possibility is that Daniel is present in the assembly, and that he joins the assembly in bowing before the golden image. Again, the text does not tell us one way or another. It is not beyond the pale, though, because I want us to consider a couple of things. First off, Daniel is not perfect. All right, the text never, ever, ever invites us to think that any of the heroes of the story are perfect. We know, scripturally, that cannot be the case. There's only one perfect man. We know Daniel had to have sinned in some way. We also know that Daniel, being so high up in the king's court, we went over this in chapter 1, that one of the things that Nebuchadnezzar teaches them, or has them do, whenever he brings in these youths, is the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans, which, as we noted, would include some stuff that, I mean, we'd give some serious side eye to. Like, why are you learning that, Daniel? Astrology, pagan magic, learning about the pagan gods. I mean, that's what their literature would have consisted of. Learning the pagan gods and their ways. One other thing that we know, just from reading through this text, meaning all of Daniel, not just Daniel chapter 3, is that the book of Daniel is very, very narrowly focused on who actually gets to play a named part in the story. The story focuses on basically two groups of people. The story is a bit of a contest, and in fact, we see this play out in Daniel chapter 3. It's like you've got two sides. And on one side, you have people who are faithful to God. And the story will focus on how their faith comes out, on how they show their faith. So in chapter 1, it's Daniel, and he thinks that the diet of the king is going to defile him. And so he comes up with an alternative, you know, some accommodation is made, and he doesn't defile himself through that diet. In chapter 2, again, it's Daniel showing that the God of Israel can do what the king has asked, that the God of Israel can reveal this dream and its interpretation, which the Chaldeans have said is impossible. Right, but Daniel goes to the king and says, no, with our God it is possible, and he does it. Right, on the other side, and of course I should mention in this chapter, it's Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah standing up and saying that they're not going to worship the idol. On the other side, you have people that... for lack of a better phrase, what they seek to do is assert human power. Now, one of the things you'll notice about Nebuchadnezzar throughout the book, and you'll notice this about some of the other kings, you'll notice this about other people in the story, is that Nebuchadnezzar is obsessed with power and empire. And we noted, by the way, this is one of Daniel's explicit aims. Because in chapter 1, he tells us that Nebuchadnezzar hauls everybody off to the land of Shinar. And we noted that Shinar is not what Babylonians would have called Babylon, the area around Babylon. Shinar is the name that comes from, you know, Genesis and the story of the Tower of Babel. And so Daniel is inviting us to consider what's happening in this book with the city of Babylon as a parallel to what happened at the Tower of Babel. And Babel is about mankind standing up against God and asserting its authority. All right, and sometimes it's kind of subtle. Like, when you go back and you read Babel, the people who are building Babel do not say to themselves, oh, let's rebel against God. They say to themselves, let's establish a name for ourselves and build a tower into the heavens. God's not even in the equation. And from their perspective, it's all about us. We're going to establish our name. We're going to establish our power. Nebuchadnezzar does exactly the same thing. So you've got these two sides. And then you also, on each side, so you have these people that you can see operating in the foreground. People like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. And then you also see in the text, who's in charge of things for that side in the background? Who's operating behind the scenes? Where does this power come from? All right, and it's a contest, this side versus this side. Now, so far, we have not seen what or who is behind the curtain for these people who are rebelling against God and asserting human authority against God. That will come out as the story progresses. But it is all, you know, this side versus the other side. Notice what is not included here. What's not included is any mention of God's people being faithless to him. All right, on the right-hand side, the right-hand column, we're talking about pagans. All right, we're talking about people who reject the God of Israel. And on the left-hand column, we're talking about people who who worship the God of Israel as they are faithful to him. All right, now if you go through the prophets spend a lot of time focusing on the people of God and how they have been faithless to him, how they've fallen short, what they're doing wrong. We don't get any of that in the book of Daniel. Daniel is not your typical prophet in that sense. So it could be that Daniel is there in the assembly bowing before the statue, and the text is just not interested in calling that out. The text is not interested in focusing on that. Instead, it is interested in focusing on the three friends and their faith. Because honestly, we can see faithlessness already in this chapter. We see all these people bowing down before the statue. We've learned what we need to learn about faithlessness, and we see it around us every day, right? It's not something that we need a particular education in at this point. What the text says we need to learn is the faithfulness of the three friends. All right, so there's no definitive answer to that question, where is Daniel in all of this? But as far as I see it, those are our options. And really, it just depends on, whichever one you want to go with. Do we want to imagine Daniel being exempted from this and just hanging out in the king's palace that day? Or do we imagine Daniel out there on the plain and this being his moment of failure? We honestly do not know, but that gets to the question. Any questions or comments before we continue on? Yes, Daniel wrote the book. Yeah, there's that too. Yeah, I mean, obviously he's inspired. But yes, he got the story that he's recording here from somewhere. Now, exactly how that happened, again, we're not privy to. So, but yeah, make what you will of it. So, good question. Any other questions or comments before we move on? All right, on Thursday, the last thing that we left off with was we began to consider all of the repetition in this text, and just how wordy it is. I think that Bob even said it was is annoying just how wordy and repetitive this chapter is. So what's going on here? I mean, let's reread the first seven verses, and we can just get a taste of it just in these first seven verses. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. By the way, that's not the last time you're going to hear that. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Really, did he set that up? Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You get the sense, as Daniel is telling this story, that he can't go half a sentence without throwing in an absurdly long list of something. It doesn't even matter what it is, just so long as there's a list of it. It needs to make its way into this text. So look at all the lists that we have, all of the people that are gathered together. That list is run through twice in successive sentences. There's the peoples, nations, languages. The herald doesn't just say, okay, everybody. But he's really formal with it. All peoples, nations, and languages. And any time that I talk about what's happening in Daniel 3, I just say that Nebuchadnezzar struck up the band. Right? But that's not what the text says. We get the list of all the instruments in the band, and we get it more than once. And that's not the end of the repetitiveness. I mean, we've noted that the text tells us over and over and over again, who set up the golden image? King Nebuchadnezzar set up the golden image. And even then, notice here, the punishment, whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. Y'all get how redundant that is? Burning, fiery furnace. What are furnaces normally used for, if not fires? But it's not just a furnace, it's a fiery furnace. It is a burning, fiery furnace. Right? And as you're reading through this, you're supposed to laugh. I mean, you're supposed to chuckle to yourself at just how ridiculous this whole thing is. It's not that Daniel has just all of a sudden become a horrible writer. Daniel is doing this intentionally to poke a ton of fun at this whole situation. All of this is intended to point out just how absurd everything is here. Because does Nebuchadnezzar take this seriously? He's dead serious. I mean, literally, he is deadly serious about what's going on here. Yeah. So, but you get this sense that there's a lot of pomp and circumstance built up around this idol. And Daniel, and by the way, this is true of anybody who takes themselves too seriously. The best way to make fun of them is to take them as seriously as they do, right? Nebuchadnezzar obviously takes this very, very seriously. And Daniel is just, what Daniel's doing is he's answering the fool according to his folly, after a fashion here. And that he said, well, if we want some pomp here, well, let's include some pomp. And he includes all of these ridiculous long lists. Now, the force of all of this is to make this entire affair, besides seeming absurd, make it also seem kind of lifeless and mechanistic. There's really not any... in these first seven verses, there are really no interesting characters here. Right? There's just this description of what's going on and the command, this is what you're going to do. And notice how the assembly reacts. They're almost like Pavlov's dog here. Right? Pavlov's dog, he rings the bell and the dog automatically begins to salivate. The assembly, Nebuchadnezzar strikes up the band, they fall down and worship. Right? It's an automatic response. They're like robots. And notice here, we don't know who any of them are. We don't know who the assembly is, other than just generally their position. We don't have any names here. They're all nameless. And as we've noted, this could include Daniel. We noted on Thursday, this could include King Zedekiah. We know that Zedekiah had to take a trip to Babylon for something roughly similar, to pay fealty to King Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah could have been talking about this whenever he talks about Zedekiah going to Babylon. Daniel here does not bother to tell us who is in the assembly. It's like they have lost some part of their humanity here, and that they are just reacting like robots to a conditioned response. And all of this is supposed to give us the sense that, well, like worshiper, like God here. In other words, as the assembly is silly and absurd and kind of lifeless and nameless and meaningless, well, so too is the idol. The idol is lifeless. The idol is absurd. The idol is not a living thing. All right, so the language that Daniel uses here is intended to be a strong satire against what Nebuchadnezzar has set up. All right, but this is not the only satirical thing that Daniel is doing in the text, just the language that he uses. You also consider the placement within the book. Right, as we've noted here, that there's no chronological marker here. It doesn't tell us what year this happened. Probably there has been some time that takes place between Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 3. Right, so Nebuchadnezzar, who knows how long it has been. Nebuchadnezzar possibly has forgotten about what went on in Daniel chapter 2, or at the very least is not spending much time thinking about it. Because for us, as readers, we read Daniel chapter 2, we see what happens there, and then we immediately go into the events of Daniel chapter 3. And so for us, as we're reading Daniel chapter 3, there's some dramatic irony going on here. We know something, or at least we have something in our minds, that King Nebuchadnezzar, the character, does not have in his mind. Now, he ought to know it, right, because he was told it in Daniel chapter 2, but evidently it is not in his mind here in Daniel chapter 3. But consider what Daniel chapter 2 is about. It is about a statue. And remember, the statue itself is kind of ridiculous. It's made out of all sorts of different materials, and the feet are partially made out of clay. So not a particularly strong or impressive statue to begin with. But we noted, and Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar in the interpretation, that the head of gold represents who? I mean, who is the head of gold? Daniel says, you are the head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar is actually kind of pleased about that. But you are the head of gold. All right, and then ultimately what happens to that statue? Well, yeah, the fifth kingdom, right, remember the statue represents four kingdoms. Well, the fifth kingdom, the kingdom of God, comes along and smashes it. God's kingdom smashes the four other kingdoms. The mountain of the Lord comes along and crushes the statue. So we read about that, but the statue, in part, it represents Nebuchadnezzar, and that God destroys that statue, and then we immediately turn around and read about Nebuchadnezzar setting up a golden statue to assert his power and his authority. And it's ridiculous. As you're reading Daniel 3, you're screaming, Nebuchadnezzar, you ought to know better than this. Don't you remember what happens to statues that stand up against God? Evidently not. But Daniel wants us to be thinking about that, I think, which is why he has put these two stories next to each other. This also, by the way, invites us to consider the sorts of satires that the Bible uses against idols in other places. Because this idol is a other than being absurdly large, this is just a typical idol. Right? It is made of physical materials. It is part of the created order, part of the created universe. It's not, God living outside of space and time. And this idol is inanimate. It cannot move. It relies on people to make it and to set it up, which I think is part of Daniel's emphasis repeatedly on Nebuchadnezzar made it, the image that Nebuchadnezzar set up. All right, because the real power here is not the idol. The power is Nebuchadnezzar. But the prophets have a field day with these sorts of things. That people will take things that are made of wood or stone or metal and call them God. People will take these helpless idols that have to be set up with human hands and say, this thing made me. This thing sustains me. It's an obvious absurdity. It's an apparent irony. Let's look briefly at Jeremiah chapter 10. Jeremiah especially, because Jeremiah would have been writing at around the same time as Daniel. Jeremiah is an early contemporary of Daniel. And in fact, Jeremiah himself ended up in Babylon at points. Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 1. Hear the word that the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, learn not the way of the nations, nor be dismayed at the signs of the heavens, because the nations are dismayed at them. For the customs of the peoples are vanity. A tree from the forest is cut down and worked with an axe by the hands of a craftsman. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with hammer and nails so that it cannot move. Their idols are like scarecrows in a cucumber field. They cannot speak. They have to be carried, for they cannot walk. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil. Neither is it in them to do good. There is none like you, O Lord. You are great, and your name is great in might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? For this is your due. For among all the wise ones of the nations, and in all their kingdoms, there is none like you. They are both stupid and foolish. The instruction of idols is but wood. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish and gold from Uphaz. They are the work of the craftsman and of the hands of the goldsmith. Their clothing is violet and purple. They are all the work of skilled men. But the Lord is the true God. He is the living God and the everlasting King. At his wrath the earth quakes and the nations cannot endure his indignation. All right, so he sets up the comparison for us. Look at these two people who claim to be God. Only one of them actually is. All right, the God of Israel, he is the living God. And as he concludes here, at his wrath the earth quakes. All right, you can see that he's living. You can see that he's active, that he's powerful. Compare him to an idol. Now, what's the idol got? The idol doesn't have anything. The idol is made out of a chunk of wood and some silver that has to be put together by skilled craftsmen. And if it weren't for the skilled craftsmen, the idol would not exist. So don't be afraid of them. And by the way, we see Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah taking this advice here. Right, they take this seriously. You know, possibly this is something they actually heard from the mouth of Jeremiah. He would have been prophesying at this time. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither is it in them to do good. And I think one of my favorite satires against idols, and there's tons of them in the prophets, my favorite one is Isaiah chapter 44. Isaiah 44. We'll start verse 9. All who fashion idols are nothing, and the things they delight in do not profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know, that they may be put to shame. Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, and the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble, let them stand forth. They shall be terrified, they shall be put to shame together. The ironsmith takes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with his strong arm. By the way, notice that he works it with his strong arm. The prophets usually ascribe, the mighty arm, the mighty hand to the Lord. But here it's this craftsman who's got the mighty hand and the mighty arm because of what he's doing. He becomes hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. The carpenter stretches a line and he marks it out with a pencil. He shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass. He shapes it into the figure of a man, with the beauty of a man, to dwell in a house. He cuts down cedars, or he chooses a cypress tree or an oak, and lets the rain nourish it. Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes a part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it. You know, ridiculous that is. He takes part of it and he builds a fire out of it, eats off of it, warms himself. He takes the other part and he makes God. He kindles a fire. He makes it an idol and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over the half he eats meat. He roasts it and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself and says, "Ah, I'm warm. I have seen the fire." And the rest he makes into a god, his idol, and he falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." Now you just see how ridiculous it is. And all of that applies here in Daniel chapter 3. Because the idol, again, is just something made out of materials made by human hands, set up by human hands. And now Nebuchadnezzar is saying, fall down and worship this. All right, so for us, as we're reading through Daniel chapter 3, we understand just how completely absurd all of this is. All right, any questions or comments up to this point?
Yes.
Not really. Yeah, we don't have that kind of sense in this chapter. If this was a loyalty test where Nebuchadnezzar was collecting together all of his officials, that would have taken time. And I don't know if he wanted to have them all together in one place at one time for them to all engage in this worship together. That would have potentially put him out of governors for a while they're all coming in from different parts of the empire. So this could be happening at several different occasions. We don't know. At the very least, the three friends do. Yes. So because the accusation comes against them, and Nebuchadnezzar gives them another shot. Nebuchadnezzar gives them another chance to bow down and worship. Because, again, what he's really interested in is getting their loyalty. He wants to make sure that they are going to serve him. Because they're his officials. So, good question. Any other questions, comments before we move on? All right. Oh, yes. Yes. That is the way that he wants them to feel. Whenever we get to his question that he asks them, we're going to get to the full force behind that. He does want them to feel stupid about this. And in fact, that is part of the appeal of getting these people together out on the plain. There's a lot of peer pressure involved in this. And we're going to see how that plays out. But let's go ahead and start in verse 8 of Daniel chapter 3. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. All right, and as we were saying, you notice the peer pressure here. All right, it's some other officials, you know, certain Chaldeans who are coming forward and making this accusation. So there's pressure coming from that side. And we noted, I think briefly on Thursday, how there's this repetition of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's Babylonian names. And that's why we today more commonly call them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Is that Daniel 3 uses that name repeatedly. This is part of the peer pressure here. Every time those names are mentioned, they're being reminded, and we as the readers are being reminded, that they are Babylons now. They live in Babylon. Their Israelite names have been cast to the wayside. They have Babylonian names now. And as we noted in our first week of the class, these Babylonian names themselves pay homage to the Babylonian gods. All right, so that just calling them by those names repeatedly is a form of peer pressure on them. You've got a Babylonian name now. Your name honors the gods. Now you live up to that name. Right, that's the sense that we get from this. So, as we consider this command that King Nebuchadnezzar has given, bow down and worship, but let me ask a question that might seem kind of obvious, and it does have an obvious answer, but I want us to get some implications out of this. How did the three friends respond to Nebuchadnezzar's command? Nebuchadnezzar says, bow down and worship. He strikes up the band. And how do the three friends respond? Sorry? Yeah, they ignored him. And I think that's a good way to put it. They ignored him. They simply did not do what he commanded them to do. And notice what they did not do. They did not raise a huge stink about it. At least not at this point. Now we're going to see some serious sass come out of these three later in the chapter. They know how to stand up for themselves. They're not cowards. But the point of what they're doing here is simply to remain obedient to their God. They are not going out and crying from the rooftops, "This is the worst possible thing that could happen. You all should be ashamed of yourselves." Now, you know, should the Babylonians be ashamed of themselves? Well, yeah, absolutely. Although we should consider that this is not something necessarily uncommon for the Babylonians. All right, just because Nebuchadnezzar has set up a ridiculously large image, that doesn't mean that these people haven't been worshiping smaller images the whole time. All right, they're pagans. You know, pagans are gonna pagan. The three friends do not use this as an opportunity to get on the high horse. Instead, they maintain their obedience to God. These Chaldeans have to come and accuse the Jews. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar, do we get the sense that Nebuchadnezzar even noticed that they had disobeyed? No, the accusation has to come up. Nebuchadnezzar had no idea that the friends had disobeyed, and he would not have known if it had not been brought to his attention. They didn't get up in his face and say, "I can't believe what you're doing, King Nebuchadnezzar." Again, they maintain their obedience. And I think there's a lesson there for us. There are times for us to stand up and proclaim loudly whenever we see unrighteousness happening. There are also times where what we need to be concerned about is keeping ourselves obedient and faithful. And that raising a big fuss or a big stink would be inappropriate. It's something that requires discernment. Right? You have to know what the circumstance is as to whether it's appropriate to raise that sort of stink. But here, I think the three friends show us that at least that is an option. That the main thing is being obedient. The accusation that the Chaldeans bring forward. Now, the text tells us, if you're reading the English Standard Version, it says they maliciously accused the Jews. The text literally says, and this is a figure of speech, this is an idiom in their language. The text says, they ate their pieces, which were of the Judeans. In other words, you know, the Chaldeans came and they ate the pieces of the Judeans. They ate the pieces of the Jews. This is an idiom, you know, a figure of speech that means basically to maliciously accuse someone. What the Chaldeans are accusing the Jews of, and I think to make sense of this saying, what they're accusing the Jews of is not just disobedience to the king, it is disobedience to the king, but beyond that, that disobedience entails blasphemy from their perspective. One of the things you need to know about the ancient Near East is that it was common for, let's say if you outed a blasphemer in the ancient Near East, and the blasphemer was dealt with, you know, put to death or exiled, usually put to death, you got rewarded. Because what have you done? Well, you have saved the land from blasphemy. Right? Because what does blasphemy do? It doesn't just corrupt you, it corrupts the whole nation. And so a common reward in the ancient Near East for outing a blasphemer is that you get all of his stuff. Well, we see this play out in other places, like in Kings, whenever Ahab wants Naboth's vineyard. Remember, Jezebel has these two worthless men come forward and accuse Naboth of blasphemy. And so whenever he's put to death, that's how Ahab is able to get his field. Otherwise, the vineyard would just pass on to Naboth's, you know, children or to his nearest family member. Somehow Ahab gets that field. It's because Naboth has been put to death for blasphemy. The worthless men, since they have outed the blasphemer, they get his stuff, and Ahab gets the field from them. All right, so that's the motive for these worthless men to bring the false charge of blasphemy. The Chaldeans here see an opportunity, as they would in their historical context. And perhaps that is what this idiom, "they ate their pieces," signifies. That the Chaldeans are going into this expecting to get something out of it. All right, because are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego important people? Are they powerful people? Yeah, absolutely. They've got this high position. The king has promoted them. And so if you are one of these Chaldeans, and by the way, notice, how did they get this position? They got their position because Daniel did a favor to the king, and he called in that favor on behalf of his friends. The Chaldeans, having seen this, they know if you do the king a favor, the king is going to reward you. So these Chaldeans, they might even have, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's official position in their sights. If we get rid of these guys, the king, he's going to show us some favor and we're going to get this nice cushy job here in the province of Babylon. But Nebuchadnezzar, I'll tell you what, we are pretty much at the end of the class here. Let me just use this opportunity to ask them, any questions or comments up to this point? Alright, so the Chaldeans have come in, they've accused the three friends, there's some sense that they're going to get some reward out of it. And we're going to see how Nebuchadnezzar treats this. Alright, well I think it is time for us to end, it's a quarter till here. So thank you so much for your attention and your comments this morning. And we will wrap this up, Lord willing, on Thursday.